good evening and welcome to The Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan and joining me in studio I have John Crown, consultant oncologist and former senator, Gillian Van Turnhout, corporate director and former senator, John Whelan, journalist and former senator, Marie O'Halloran, parliamentary correspondent with the Irish Times, Dermot Farisher, professor of modern Irish history, UCD, and John Downing, political correspondent with the Irish Independent. Now, we want to hear from you, so do please get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte, hashtag RTELD. Now, the main focus of the programme tonight is on the Shannon. But first, I want to just touch briefly on that update on the coronavirus that broke in the last couple of hours. Four new cases confirmed in the west of Ireland. Here's Chief Medical Officer Dr. Tony Holohan speaking on the 9 o'clock news.
So I'm not confirming that it's a family, but it is our first cluster. And a cluster is a small number of cases that are linked to one another. In this case, they're linked insofar as they travelled together from an affected area. And again, in this case, it was Italy. And they're from, as you say, the west of the country. The cluster, by definition, then, is contained and the links between all of the cases are known. So it's now four out of the nine cases on the island, as you correctly reported, but each of those cases has been identified and placed in appropriate infection control procedures, and we're confident that the control arrangements around those cases can help to contain the spread of this infection.
And that was Dr. Tony Holohan there, who has, of course, become such a public figure in the last few weeks. I'll turn to you, John Crown, as our resident medic in the studio tonight. Should we be more concerned now than we were a few hours ago?
I think, Katie, once we had our first case, our first two cases, it was always inevitable we will have more. And my guess is we will have quite a few more. I think there are grounds for concern, but there are not grounds for despondency. It's very important we take the advice of the public health professionals, of which I am not one. I think it's critically important that people follow all the common sense precautions, washing their hands, staying away from sick people if they are sick, you know, alerting their doctors, you know, staying in isolation if necessary. But there are two points I really would like to make, which perhaps are being lost in the shuffle. The first one is, this is not a time for finger pointing or recrimination, but our health system has allowed to decline into a very rundown situation. It is not coping well in the absence of a crisis. It doesn't cope particularly well when we have a normal winter flu. Even if we get something which is well short of, you know, apocalyptic disaster, just another bad, bad outbreak of respiratory illness, it will put an enormous strain on the system and it will inevitably have multiple knock-on effects on other parts of healthcare. So for those reasons, it is especially important that Ireland get it right. And as I was saying, we have to hope for the best and prepare for the worst. And my own feeling is we should err on the side of caution when it comes to large public health initiatives to really try and stop this. The second point I'd like to make is there's a sort of a blasé statement that, oh, well, only a few percent of people die and there are people who are, you know, very vulnerable and, you know, are ill anyway. That's very dismissive of, for instance, cancer patients, people who have cancer, not only those who are actively on treatment, but those who have survived treatment. The early data, and I stress this in a relatively small number of cases from the first study of China, would suggest that they have a much higher chance of progressing to the real severe and life-threatening form of this illness. So we need to be really careful about not letting this thing get out there, because there are a lot of cancer survivors in Ireland. We need to look after them. We need to make sure that they get the chance to realise the prolongation of life or cure that they might have had as a result of treatment advances.
Are you giving specific advice to your patients in relation to this? What are you telling them?
I'm telling them to follow all the advice that they're getting, but to follow it really, really carefully. And I haven't yet, but I mean, I do believe we're going to be edging closer to making more draconian advice about things like travel. I don't think we're there yet. Certainly the advice at the moment is that people should not travel to those hotspot areas and keep away from them in the absence of any compelling reason to be there. But one wonders if cancer patients need to be a little bit extra careful, because for them, if they get it, it's a real problem. And it's not, Katie, just the patients. It's their family, their carers, the people who live with them, the people who might infect them, the people who might contaminate them. I'm sorry, I don't want to hog this, but just to say one more little point here. Our system is really stretched. I mean, I can tell you right now, if we had one of our nurses got a phone call at midnight saying your child's school is closed tomorrow, I mean, I'd suspect there are a lot of people who won't have childcare in play that quickly. I suspect that there are many situations where there are only one or two people doing critical jobs, and they might come into work if they had a sniffly nose in normal times. But in this situation, they will be strongly advised to stay away from work if there's a chance that they may in fact be harbouring the virus. We don't have the redundancy in the system to deal with this. We don't have enough intensive care unit beds. We don't have enough intensive specialists. So, as I said, we need to get this early public health part right.
I just got a text in here, Katie. To allow the St. Patrick's Day festival to go ahead would be an act of recklessness and irresponsibility. Imagine our already, this is the point you're making, John Crown, imagine our already inadequate health service trying to cope with large numbers of COVID-19 patients, some of them perhaps tourists falling ill while here for the celebrations. John, what's your sense of how this is being managed and the public reaction to how it's being managed?
It's a bit faltering. What I find about it is that on one level it's kind of made for a caretaker government, because I think the public messaging is always far better done by senior officials and professionals, because it takes the political dynamic out of it and changes the code, particularly in broadcast journalism and briefings generally. So that's rather good. The consequences of it is what I worry about, particularly economic fallout and social fallout, does require political management. And I do wonder, we have a government, albeit a caretaker government, but I do wonder about its authority. This inevitably is going to go on quite a bit, I fear. And I wonder about a caretaker government which is managing, which has a questionable mandate about them, particularly the economic fallout from this and the consequences of people losing money, losing income, losing livelihood because of various cancellations and so on.
OK, well, that brings us neatly to the next item on the agenda, which is the negotiations for government, or non-negotiations for government, as we're being told. Marie, were you following that meeting today? Were you covering that meeting today between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil?
Covering that, I'd leave that to John. He knows the ins and outs of the details.
Well, they met for a time today.
Six and a half hours or something, was it?
Yes. And they talked about, we're told they talked about policy. They agreed to keep everything confidential. So God knows what they talked about. They could have been talking very much about Cheltenham if it goes ahead or whatever, for all we would know. But we assume they were talking about talks. So again, a bit like the first topic, this one, we're looking longer rather than shorter at this one as well.
Pierce Doherty saying today, the farce of pretending that they are not engaged in negotiations is insulting and will fool nobody. Do we believe that they're not actually negotiating some sort of an arrangement?
Well, history teaches us that even in all coalition negotiations up to now, even before the final count was done, there were contacts, back channels. So certainly it would be, politicians being politicians, it would be absolutely flabbergasting if they weren't.
Well, as the history professor is sitting beside you there, Dermot Farrater, what do you think is happening here?
Well, they need to stop hiding behind history, because there's an extraordinary casualness about what is being said. There's no urgency there that anyone can seem to.
Well, the 74 days seems to be the initial target.
But I mean, the fact that they keep reiterating that 74 days as if that's some kind of thing to be reached for. You know, there was talk earlier on about this dragging on to the summer. That's not good enough. There needs to be a lot more urgency around it. Two conflicting messages seemed to come out of those discussions today, even though they were confidential. One is that we're still preparing for opposition, Fine Gael. The other is, from Fianna Fáil, we're ready to move on to the next stage. So who's moving on to the next stage? With whom? There does seem to be just this... it's related to John's point about a caretaker government, even though there is no such thing officially as a caretaker government, you know, and there aren't caretaker ministers either. You know, they're in situ.
But no government in this position will make any political...
The demeanour is remarkably revealing. You know, these are not people who seemed to be serious about government formation. And that's something that should concern us all. And it's not just about the current public health crisis. It's all the other crises that we've heard so much about in the last couple of months. And suddenly we're not hearing anything about them at all.
Yeah, John Whelan.
Yeah, I suppose the two things are connected, the coronavirus and this whole question of sort of, you know, this shadow boxing or shadow play that's going on. All it will take is for this coronavirus to escalate, and the public mood and sentiment around, you know, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil playing games or being seen to in the public eye, the optics of it are not good. And I would have thought that the opinion poll at the weekend in the Sunday Times, which says that not only has the Sinn Féin vote not softened, but in fact it's consolidated and increased. So the idea of a second election might not be too appealing to them. And, you know, there is this adage of, you know, your worst days in government are better than your best days in opposition. But I think the public will tire of this very soon if they don't crack on and sort it out.
Okie doke. Well, let's crack on ourselves, because I do want to move on to the reason we have gathered you all here this evening. With the election of the 26th Seanad underway, this is where we tell you everything you ever wanted to know about the Seanad, but were afraid to ask. Who gets to run? Who gets to vote? What do senators actually do? And after one attempt to abolish it and 14 attempts to reform it, why is the political system so stubbornly resistant to changing it?
Friday can't happen too quickly for me. This member of the plebs is impatient to let those members of an elite know where I'd like to house them. I'm aiming to rehouse them in the reject bin of history. Gone is good enough for me.
When the Fine Gael poster says fewer politicians, what it means in reality is less democracy. You mightn't like it, but we are a personification of democracy.
One argument will be that this is a power grab by the government. Well, that's nonsense, because the Seanad has no power. To keep the Seanad is a power grab, because it only serves the political parties that use it, to put their friends in positions to get money from the system.
And that was Owen Murphy there, some voices from both sides of the debate on the abolition of the Seanad back in 2013. So we'll get some of the arguments for and against the Upper House shortly. But first, let's just go right back to basics. Marie, there are 60 senators. Let's go through how the various blocks of them are elected. So 11 of them aren't elected at all.
That's right. 11 of them are Taoiseach's nominees. And that means the Taoiseach of the day gets to appoint 11 people of his or her choosing. It has been a he up to now. And in recent governments, because they've been coalition governments, the other parties get a certain number of seats are in the Seanad from the Taoiseach's quota. Then you also have six university.
Okay, let's stick with that first, because we have a former Taoiseach's nominee in the studio. Gillian, right. Is there a Gillian van Turnhout? Is there lobbying for this? Do you just get the call out of the blue?
No, you get the call out of the blue, because I was in the back of a taxi in Shanghai when I got my phone call. So
a glamorous life, Gillian.
I was there for the EU and actually working on children's rights. I had lobbied all of the parties, you know, before the election. I was a formerly chief executive of Children's Rights Alliance, and I was at the time of my appointment, and I had lobbied obviously a lot on the issues around children's rights. Enda Kenny had made the decision to set up the Department of Children and Youth Affairs in 2011, and I believe my appointment was part of that, about doing some redress on all the wrongs that we did to children in our history.
And as, because obviously a lot of the Taoiseach's nominees will be party members that he'll want to kind of set up again, yeah, for the thing. And I presume the number, then there's always a number of trophy, if I can call you that, independent nominees.
Traditionally it has been that the 11, you know, they often would say about the Seanad, like it's either the retirement home or the incubator for the future. And traditionally the Taoiseach's nominees have been political appointees. But actually in 2011, Eamon Gilmore got four nominees and Enda Kenny got seven nominees. And of the seven, I think it was five or six he appointed. Six were from civil society, arts, business.
And can you maintain your independence then once you've gone in as a Taoiseach's nominee? Are you then expected to support the government?
Well, different people will take different approaches. We set up an independent group. So we created history by having our own group of independents. I had the honour of being the leader of that group for the 5 years. And, you know, my approach was I tried to vote with government where I could, because I had been appointed. However, when I couldn't, I would clearly articulate it and explain why I wasn't voting with the government.
OK, Marie, that's our 11 Taoiseach's nominees. Then there's six
there's the six university senators who were appointed by three by the graduates of the University of Dublin, Trinity College, and three by the graduates of the NUI universities. And I think one of the things that's interesting about that is the electorate. So NUI in 2016, the electorate was, I think, an estimated 102,000. And the Trinity College electorate was 56,000.
Now, how many of them actually vote?
And, well, I know that of the NUI electorate, John might know more about this, but of the NUI electorate, the last time, about 40,000 of the 102,000 voted.
Which is not a bad turnout, actually, given the nature of the thing. John, you came in through this route.
Yeah, we used to say we were elected in the largest national parliamentary constituency. and with no disrespect to my good friend Gillian, our group of university independents, we thought we were the independents. We thought they were the independents. But no.
Heard it 100 times.
Yeah, I know. But look, I don't get a chance to tell a joke too often anymore.
So why did you put yourself forward for this?
It was a whim. No, it wasn't exactly a whim, but I can tell you, a friend of mine, I had been very involved in advocacy and health service reform over about 20 years since I came back to Ireland. I had seen such incredible deficiencies in the health system, and I was writing papers and doing radio interviews and founding research organizations and cancer groups. And I thought, you know, we really need to fix this. And the two then aspirant parties of government in the 2011 election had a more or less joint approach, which was going to give a very fundamental reform of the health system. And it struck me it might be a very exciting time to be there. A friend of mine called me and said, you know, you should really run for the Shannon on the NUI panel. I had never thought of it. It was about a week before the deadline. And he said, you'd be very well credentialed for it. You know, you've been an advocate. You'd have a certain level of expertise. And the Shannon, those seats are supposed to bring something other than just, you know, professional politicians in. And there had been many people who had done a wonderful job there, ranging from W.B. Yeats to Fergal Quinn to David Norris in those seats. And I felt, well, you know, why don't I just have a go? And I really, I must say, enjoyed it. I found it really, really personally satisfying, but very frustrating at the same time, because as soon as we got in, the new government pretty much said, we're not going to reform the health service. And that to me was, I lost a great deal of interest in a lot of the advocacy issues at that stage. I tried to use the platform for continually highlighting the deficiencies in the health service, hoping that somebody would listen. Now, 9 years later, after the election, I would have to say nobody was particularly paying too much attention, because all of those deficiencies are still there. I got involved in a few other areas as well, like Shannon reform itself. When I made my acceptance speech, I said the Shannon electoral system is an affront to democracy. I said I will never, ever run again for this unless they reform it. And when I was in the Shannon with the assistance of Shane Keneally, a wonderful assistant I had working for me, we drafted a Shannon reform bill, which of course was defeated, but which would have been the maximum reform, the most democratic reform, which could have been achieved without changing the constitution. It would have given every citizen of the country a vote for the Shannon, but of course it was defeated. But what can I say? I'm very glad I did it.
You weren't tempted to go again?
No. I found it very interesting in some ways. I mean, I knew what my day job was. I love medicine. I love cancer research. And it was very hard to do all of these things at the same time. And to tell you the truth, I did make a promise. And I don't want to personalize it, but other politicians who made promises at a time when they were elected to things about not running again, it really annoyed me when
it's
they
generally
did.
Generally the most often frequently broken promise.
Yeah, but I thought I wouldn't run again. If they didn't reform it, they didn't reform it, I didn't run again.
Okay, just before we move on, I'll come back to you, Marie, about the very complicated system of the other 43 senators and how we get them. But just in relation to those two sections, Dermot, the Taoiseach's nominees and the university senators. What the purpose of that? There's a very specific purpose for both of those.
Well, I mean, originally the Shannon under the 1922 constitution was supposed to be catering for minority voices. You know, there was a concern about the minority problem.
Well,
after
Protestants, let's say it out loud. The only real minority we were concerned
about.
Yeah,
but it wasn't just about Protestants, you know. I mean, by the late 1920s, 93% of the new Free State was Catholic. It was an overwhelmingly Catholic country. So yes, there have been commitments made by the likes of Arthur Griffith during the period of the treaty negotiations that we will cater for the minority voice. But there were also commercial interests, and there were business interests, and there were cultural interests. You know, Yeats wasn't just there because he was a Protestant. He was also there because he was a poet. And, you know, he was something of a trophy because of his cultural standing. But it was largely to cater for, you know, that minority in the religious sense. 1922, the Constitution. The Shannon could be got rid of without a referendum, and it was
and
temporarily
it was.
In 1936. And this question then of whether it could become a proper vocational assembly was raised. There's a lot of talk in the 1930s about vocational organisation of society, functional organisation of society, that the different interest groups that exist, you know, that you need to have an assembly that would reflect those various interests in a way that perhaps wasn't catered for in the Dáil. The problem, though, was that even though De Valera made very pious announcements about this in the middle of the 1930s, the most important thing was that it would be controlled by the government of the day and ultimately by the Dáil. So those vocational panels really became abused, even though they're there. The Shannon, or the university seats, of course, had historically been there, again, to represent a different interest, the idea that you would have the academic oversight or the academic expertise not sullied by the grubbiness of day-to-day politics, you know. But it really was. There was a cynicism about the way in which it was being used. De Valera actually abolished the Shannon. It went into storage for about 19 months. And it was then reintroduced in 1937.
In the form we now have it.
Now, when you look at it, I mean, we've actually got to put it in the context of the evolution of our political culture. You know, we have an extraordinarily centralised system of governance. You know, we have had since the foundation of the state. That's not unusual in a state that's coming out of civil war. But there was nothing really done in a meaningful way to try and counteract that. If anything, it was further enhanced by the way in which the Shannon was used. Having said all of that, and these arguments were very much to the fore in 2013 during the referendum, it did still provide a forum for voices that were not being heard in the Dáil. And there were some really impressive senators and contributors. They had a lot of important things to say. But what the Shannon did ultimately was power.
But in many cases, John, and you know this from many years in Leinster House, there may be very important things being said in the Shannon, but a lot of the time there's nobody there to record it and to report it.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Yeah. I remember one political correspondent retiring from, shall remain nameless, 29 years he was in Leinster House, and his proudest boast was he had never crossed the threshold of well, Shannon Éireann, nor written Shannon Éireann.
I have a memory of some debate that took us into the Shannon for some controversy blew up, and we had to, for some reason, cover something that was on in the Shannon. And this is when I was on the Dáil gallery. And a gang of us, political correspondents, trooped into the press benches. And I remember, I think it might have been Mrs. O'Rourke who caught our eye and said, "You found your way then." So, because it was.
And we had to be shown, particularly kindly, Usher had to show us precisely where to sit.
And Mary found her way because she lost her Dáil seat.
But it is an issue in that.
It is. Yes.
It doesn't get it covered. Is. But is it that, you know, is it a bit of a chicken and egg thing? It doesn't get covered because it doesn't matter as much as what happens in the other chamber.
Absolutely. It is chicken and egg. And I have been at Leinster House a long time. And I have always found, I'm pretty pro Shannon, even though I have written very little about it in all my various years. But I have found the characters and the people in the Shannon among the more interesting in Leinster House generally.
Competition wasn't possibly too hot for that particular accolade. But,
I wouldn't think so. No. I found very many interesting people across all sectors, across all parties, and even in the last Shannon, people like Padraig O'Keefe, and among others.
I think senators used to find it very annoying how it became tabloid fodder. That, I mean, you'd make some very, like somebody like Sean Barrett would make some incredibly reasoned, lengthy series of amendments to some very technical, you know, financial bill, you know, that no one else had thought of doing, would never get covered. But if one of our other colleagues made some remark that could be misinterpreted as being a bit personal, that could end up being a tabloid headline.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was all.
Well, I think that's very unfair to the person who's sitting right beside you there, John Crown, because Marie, you do, and the Irish Times has made an effort to have some some stories from the Shannon when on days that it's sitting.
Yes, we do. We do. We're always watching and listening. At least we're listening.
And and the more technical amendment, the better.
In fairness, some of the amendments are so technical that you couldn't possibly make them interesting to a general audience.
And in some ways, that is the point of the Shannon, that they do that dog donkey work.
And that has been one of the advantages of the Shannon, that it has made amendments to legislation that the Dáil may, on a political basis, because it gets so politicised, when it goes into the Shannon, they do. There are a lot more, I would have to say. Well, they have been in the past collegial.
Yeah, the debate is less
heated.
And it's less partisan. Yeah. And
I think the Shannon has been particularly good at dealing with very sensitive issues and being able to. So when I've noticed ministers tactically have brought legislation first to the Shannon if it needs teasing out and having a proper debate. I've seen on particularly on justice issues, and I think that's when the Shannon has been
before
used.
The rabid dogs descend on it.
But even on very sensitive issues, I was actually thinking about it during the week when I was watching the redress programmes that RTE did, which were really excellent. You know? It brought to my mind Senator Owen Sheehy Skeffington, who came into the Shannon in 1954. Absolutely. He was raising these kind of issues when there was no real public discourse about them, and they certainly weren't being discussed in the Dáil. And that was an example of how the Shannon could be a forum to discuss important things. And again, you can say it's just discussion, but that discussion was needed. And this question that arose there about oversight and scrutiny, obviously the Shannon has the power of delay. It doesn't have the power of veto. And for all the talk of technicalities, it's that slowing down to get to grips with the nuts and bolts, which is significant. And one of the contexts for the 2013 referendum was about the way in which decisions were being made. You know, this was a time, there was a particular context there in relation to the existence of the Economic Management Council, for example, which was, four men at the heart of government who were making all the decisions. And the point was being made, again, that everything was being sucked into that centre, which was becoming smaller and smaller. And where was the oversight and the scrutiny that was needed? So the question then became, could that become in some way, more focused? You know, all of this talk about reform, you mentioned there 14, different, reform reports or proposals over the years. You know, a lot of those proposals are about strengthening that idea of scrutiny and oversight, but of course also making it more representative. It was very difficult to talk about the Shannon and its contribution without giving due attention to the electorate. And the ridiculous, as you say, I mean, it was an affront. And there are some people who have two votes in the Shannon elections, and there are many who have none.
Well, there are people.
Yeah, go on, John.
The point made by Marie beside me here this morning in the Irish Times, there's some people can actually have seven votes. Because if you think of it like this, take a county councillor who happens to have a BA from the NUI and an MA from TCD. Yeah. He could have seven votes, five in the vocational panels elected by councillors and one in each of the university constituencies. I was interested, Dermot, talking about the history of the involving the educational institutions. In July 1979, a referendum was passed to expand to what was then a burgeoning third level sector to use the third level seats to move them out from just TCD and NUI. It was carried. Now, mind you, the turnout was only 28%. But it was overwhelmingly carried, and then for the ensuing 41 years, utterly nothing was done about it. And that of itself tells everything.
But
about
even
it.
In 2013, this was Enda Kenny's proposal to abolish it, to make the Republic fit for purpose. But he point blank refused to debate his own proposal.
Indeed. I want to get to that in a minute. But before we go there, I just want to get to these 43 vocational seats that are elected through the vocational panels, because it is incredibly complicated how it can be done. And thank God we have Marie O'Hanlon here to explain it to us. So it's five different panels.
So you've five vocational panels which represent, I suppose, industrial, cultural, education sectors, bodies, interests across the country. So you have the agricultural sector, the agricultural panel, administrative panel, cultural and education panel, the labour panel and the administrative panel. And they each have a certain number of seats. And basically there are inside nominations and outside nominations.
Yes, insider jobs and outsider jobs.
Outsider jobs.
But in terms of, sorry, there's over 100 nominating bodies out
there's
there.
There's 111 nominating bodies, and each nominating body can nominate one person, with the exception of the Labour panel, which only has two nominating bodies, which are the ICTU, the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, and then the Irish Conference of Professional and Service Association, which actually is like a federation of 10 affiliates, which you have, and on that you have the Garda Representative Association.
Okay, we won't go through the whole 10
of
them.
That. But
just the idea of this idea is so that you would get, I mean, on paper it sounds, you know, very democratic or representative, that you actually get represent. But the reality is that, and I see a line here from a texter, the Shannon is the proof that there is life after death, from Mrs. John and Kerry. First of all, let's go through the inside nominations.
So an inside nomination is a party nomination, and under that, you, if you want to be a candidate, and the parties, they can control this, you have to get the signatures of four senators and or TDs. And so that means a maximum, each TD and senator can nominate one person. So that means the parties and independents can nominate a maximum of 55 people, because in total there are 160 TDs and 60 senators.
But in practice, I mean, do all the parties do this? Because I'm aware the big parties do gather up, like get all the members of their parliamentary party to sign blank nomination papers, and then they decide where they need, well, you know, maybe aspiring TDs to be.
Yeah, that does sound kind of fishy, and some of the parties do that. The smaller parties, for example, Labour Party, the Green Party, they have the vote. Like last Saturday, the Central Council, the Executive Board of the Labour Party, were going in to vote on their four nominations, and all the potential candidates were allowed to lobby the voters as they went in to vote. But then they decided, the parties, now they did have their nominating TDs and senators sign blank forms, but they had voted to decide to pick their four nominees. So therefore, then they filled in those names on the nominees, and that was to control the panels they went on, to control the vote, to enhance their chances of getting them elected.
Okay, so John Whelan, you came through this vocational panel route.
Yes.
Explain, remind people of how your dalliance with politics.
Yeah, well, I was an absolutely accidental politician, and certainly an accidental senator. It was not something that I planned or envisaged. I ran for the general election in 2011 in the Laois Offaly constituency out of a frustration and an anger that, you know, the country was, I suppose, on its knees, and we, you know, people were losing their jobs. I had lost my job. I was unemployed for the first time in my life, and it was a terrible shock. And people were losing their homes, people were losing their lives. And so I was, I suppose, recruited by the Labour Party. I was writing a lot at the time for the Sunday Independent, articulating these issues. And, you know, found myself in the middle of a general election before I knew it, as the Cowan government collapsed in disarray. I ended up with over 9,000 votes, didn't get elected, narrowly beaten for the last seat in Laois Offaly. And I went home that night, you know, saying that's my foray, like the Asses Gallop, short and sweet, my involvement with politics. And I got a call the next day saying, you're running in the Senate elections.
You got one of the inside nominations.
Well, I was never an insider, and I don't think anyone in the Labour Party regarded me as one either, certainly not after my term.
But you were nominated by the Labour Party, from nominations within the parliamentary party.
Well, you're encouraged to seek an outside one if you can secure one, because that gives the party more firepower and more candidates if necessary. It is a very archaic and labyrinthine process. You know, Dermot and I were just looking before we came in at the list of the nominating bodies. I think, apart from the fact that there's over 100 of them, people would be fascinated with, you know, the Irish Greyhound Breeders Association, the vintners.
Very important body.
Yeah, but there's all, I mean, I'm not taking or casting aspersions on any of them or their merits, but you know, the Irish Thoroughbred Breeders Association, the National Association of Regional Game Councils, the Irish Georgian Society,
Dental Council.
The Dental Council, the Drama League of Ireland, they all can nominate you to run for the Shannon. So that's the so-called outside panel. The inside panel is probably correctly termed as it is, you're on the inside track with the political party that put you forward.
Yeah, because then the word will go out to, say, in your case, Labour councillors, this is our man, this is who we'd like you to give the nod to.
Correct. And technically speaking, the party councillors, because it's important to remember that those 43 seats are elected by county councillors. No one else has a vote in that regard. And so you tour the country literally, you know, asking for their support, talking to them and trying to persuade them. Very often, there's also internal rivalry, you have to remember, because there could be two or three party colleagues on the same panel. So it's quite cutthroat. And then after that,
there's legions of stories about this touring of the country by aspiring senators, up every boreen in the country, meeting every dog that they never wanted to meet.
Yeah, well, I think what's quite fascinating,
getting told a lot of lies by councillors.
Yeah, well, I think what's quite fascinating is the enthusiasm to which a number of TDs who, with great gusto, called for and campaigned and canvassed for the abolition of the Shannon, were very glad of the sight of the Shannon around the corner come 2016 and so on. And some of them have revived their political careers off the back of it. But not one of them have campaigned for absolute and real reform. And I have a love-hate relationship with the Shannon. I enjoyed my time there. I think we put in a good shift. But it's an absolute scandal. And it's not that hard to enact the basic reforms that Maurice Manning and his committee came forward with. In order to bring the Shannon into the 20-whatever century we're in and to give make it more relevant and more robust, and that it's not just a puppet of the government of the day or being used as a nursery or a nursing home for politicians.
Yeah, just in relation to those vocational plans, finally, before we leave it, Marie, there's a tiny electorate. For those?
It's a total electorate of just under 1,200. What John was saying there, it operates that it's the incoming Dáil, which is 160, the outgoing Shannon, which is 60, and just over 900 councillors. And so it's just under 1,200 in total. So then they get to vote, each of them gets to vote on each vocational panel. So it is that five votes. And then if they have the NUI and the Trinity graduation, they can vote on those as well. So some councillors will have six or even seven votes. And I think that's what makes it, what it's also what John was saying about the reform and the eight or 14
attempts
that at every election, everybody's always interested in the Shannon. Big debate in Shannon reform. As soon as the election's over, that's it, gone, forgotten about, and we move on.
OK, well, let's go back to 2013 then. And of course, it was Enda Kenny who launched this referendum to abolish the Shannon, to kill it off altogether. Let's have a quick listen.
The key difficulty with all of the proposals for reform is that they take the existence of the Shannon with its widely acknowledged flaws as a given. It would either remain an unrepresentative elitist composition or a directly elected entity. Instead, the correct approach is to start by asking whether we need a second house at all. I do not believe that we do. What could be more appropriate or more democratic than asking the people to decide on the future of the Shannon following 75 years of inaction by the political establishment?
Indeed. What could be more?
Well, what worried me about that was there seemed to me to be a really anti-intellectual commitment to a shrinkage of governance. And if we take one of the definitions of a republic as being about the distribution of power as widely as possible, this was really a slap in the face for the republic or for the idea of dispersal of power. And I say anti-intellectual because, of course, you could make compelling reasons for getting rid of the Shannon. But there were even more compelling reasons for keeping it and reforming it.
Well,
he was not engaging with those ideas.
Let me just give you a couple, just a sense of what we're getting at. The Shannon is a home for trendy elites and failed and soon to fail politicians. It would be gone. Only the people chose to give Enda Kenny a kicking, when he wanted to get rid of it. Time to revisit abolition, says Martin in Boyle. Katie, the referendum on abolishing the Shannon was deliberately sabotaged by a very unclear ballot paper. Many people who voted no thought they were voting to get rid of the Shannon. And I think there is a, and both those are two good points. There was a lot of politics around that. Our very undemocratic Shannon suits the political class.
But it's
a hard child to love in many ways.
No, it is. And I mean, I think John's right about the love-hate relationship. I think a lot of people have a love-hate relationship. And a lot of people who are campaigning to retain the Shannon had a love-hate relationship with it. But this issue of Enda Kenny refusing whatsoever to debate it, that also backfired. It did allow people also, though, to come together. I remember the late Fergal Quinn, who I had a lot of time for, even though I had very little in common with him. You know, he didn't need to be in the Shannon to make a living or for profile or to approve his competence. He was there because he was serious about it. And he was very committed to this idea of reform, and he campaigned, the late Noel Whelan as well. We didn't have a vested interest in the Shannon remaining in that sense. What we were interested in was, how is this country governed? And there just seems to be a further shrinkage being countenanced here, almost with relish, including by those who ultimately and ironically and hypocritically were going to need it and going to use it when it suited them.
Gillian, you were 5 years there.
Yeah.
My sense is that you did think it was useful.
I managed to bring through laws that I know wouldn't have happened in the Dáil. So Dermot mentioned earlier Eoin Sheehy Skeffington, who tried in the 60s to bring in a law to stop corporal punishment of girls in schools and failed. It was only him and one other who voted. And I managed to bring in the ban on corporal punishment of children in the home, which I was counselled behind the scenes, don't do it, the time's not right, don't interfere in the role of the family. And my feeling was, if I don't do it, who will do it? Because if you're going before the electorate, the council is not to do it. And not knowing how my colleagues felt about it, I said at least children in Ireland would know an adult is saying you should not be hit. Thankfully, to all of my colleagues, they all supported that proposal. And since my time in the Shannon, I've now helped Scotland and Wales to bring in similar laws in that area. Did a lot of work on the Public Health Alcohol Bill against the tobacco companies. John and myself, you know, we got legal threats and everything, but we used the platform that we had to take on those interests. So for me, it was there was many pieces of legislation that I was able to amend and change to make sure children in court cases will get an explanation in language that is appropriate to them. So for me, I used every minute of time I had, but I knew I only had the 5 years and that was it.
And there's a sense as well, like that it's a cushy number for people and that, you know, you don't sit that often, you get very well paid, there's good expenses. I mean, are all those fair criticisms?
Well, I certainly gave it my all and it was a full-time job for me. I gave up my job at the Children's Rights Alliance. I know, you know, not everybody, you know, does that. So I decided, because of the way I wanted to approach it, I knew I only had 5 years because I was a Taoiseach's nominee. My first job in life was in the private sector. I then went to the Children's Rights Alliance. I then went to the Shannon. My salary has gone down in every single job I've had. So actually, if you know, now my job satisfaction went up. So I'm not complaining about it. But the idea that I think as the public, we should have an expectation of what we expect from our politicians and our parliamentarians and hold them to account. And very often, I suppose it would frustrate me when I'd see some colleagues would do the banging and thumping of the tables because I know that they're going to go missing for 2 weeks after they told them up there in Dublin what to say. So I do think we have to have greater accountability for our parliamentarians. But if you do work at it, as I saw many colleagues work hard, It is a tough job because you hear all of the wrongs that are happening in your country. Now, you also hear all of the wonderful things that people are doing that doesn't make the headlines, but you do have to balance it.
John Crown, you obviously held down your other incredibly pressured, I'm sure, job while also, as you say, you know, running with quite a few hairs in the Shannon. Is that possible or really is that, you know, ultimately not the way to do it?
Well, I like to think that I actually was living up to the spirit of the 1937 Constitution, because it was people who were doing that kind of role that they wanted in the Shannon. They wanted people who were not coming in as full-time politicians and who would bring a different level, a different life experience, and a different, I'm not saying a better life experience, but a different life experience and a different expertise. So I like to think I was actually doing that. I had to, obviously it was very, very busy 5 years for me, because I more or less continued doing my medical practice and research, a lot of late nights, a lot of moving clinics to nighttime and things like that. And, you know, I had a lot of support from my colleagues in work and thanked them all very much for it. As a backbencher, as an independent backbencher from the opposition side, I got a bill passed, which is very, very, Dermot might be able to help me on this. I suspect that there have only been a handful of times in the history of Iraq and Syria when that has happened.
Very rare.
Yeah. And it was the one that banned smoking in cars when a child was present. Now, one would say that wasn't the most important bill in the world. And I always said, I'm not bringing in this bill to see prosecutions. I bring in the bill for education. It actually made people stop and think about this habit, which wasn't that rare at the time, that people would smoke in a car with a child present. I got the gagging order taken out of the GP contract. And I like to think that basically I continued what had been a role as an advocate with a different form. I wish it had been more, I hate that word, impactful. I wish we had managed to actually see the reform of the health service. It didn't happen, and there's no sign of it happening now, I'm afraid.
I just want to bring John back in. Like, when we look at the most recent of the 14, we're now seeing the 14 attempts, and the most recent one, of course, was the Maurice Manning report of 2015. Mm-hmm. And then there was the implementation group that was chaired by Michael McDougall in 2016. And there was a piece of legislation which didn't get through because, again, there wasn't enough consensus. So, like, in terms of reform, obviously the electorate is an issue, a huge issue.
Well, you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but you have to make sure that the Shannon is fit for purpose, is relevant, and that the public feel they have a stake in it, that it isn't just something that county councillors elect.
But then how do you stop it being having the same electorate for both chambers?
You can have a hybrid model. For instance, you could have a situation where you cannot contest the Dáil election and the Shannon election, and that would cut out people sort of, you know, using it as a fallback or safety net position. You could have the election on the same day.
Yeah, so that was one of Ivana Bacic's proposals.
Yes, and to be fair, Ivana Bacic has been pioneering reform in this area.
And that would cut out the idea of failed yes, Dáil politicians
and it would encourage,
using it.
And I mean, I want to challenge you on the point you made. It's not a cushy number or a sort of a, you know, lucrative expenses and highly paid. I mean, most people in there, you know, had jobs that would have probably paid them better. You know, it's not necessarily something like that. I mean, you know, you can put in a good shift and give good value for money, and not everyone is freewheeling or free boating in it. The other thing is, I think the nominee...
But not everyone isn't either.
No, except that. But that would apply to everywhere. The nominating bodies as well, that needs to be radically reformed. And you know, because some of them, I don't even know if some of those organisations still exist or if they even
You'll have trouble extracting the dentists.
Yeah. Okay, good one. And the other thing is that you can't break down. We already have, 43 from councillors, 6 from universities, 11 from the Taoiseach. It wouldn't be too difficult to hive off a certain number of seats at least from across the country that could be elected by universal vote and give the public a stake and a say in the...
Can I just... brought in a reform bill, and the reform bill would have given every citizen of the country a vote in those panels. It would have required no change in the Constitution. You would have gone in on general election day, taken your Dáil voting paper, and then you would have nominated one of the different panels and said, I'd like to vote in the agricultural panel, I'd like to vote in the industrial panel. So every citizen would have had a vote for the Dáil and a vote for the Shannon.
Yeah,
we wouldn't have had to change the Constitution.
Right. The Manning report suggests a one-person, one-vote system, and it would be extended to include Irish citizens in Northern Ireland and those living overseas who hold valid Irish passports. A lot more of those now than there was when Maurice Manning did that report.
Yeah.
And that there would be provision for online registration of voters, downloading of ballot papers. But that would have increased the electorate from the tiny 1,200 that you were talking
almost
about there,
a million,
to 5.3 million people. So, well, I mean, how practical are these suggestions?
It has to be manageable and it has to be practical. But the point about it being different to a general election vote is that, you know, we live in a system where we have multi-seat constituencies elected under the single transferable vote under PR. And how often have we heard that politicians as a result of that system, even though we like it, you know, are far too focused on the parish pump, on the constituency matters. And that's not to deride them. But the argument was, of course, well, the Shannon does need to be different and it can be chosen in a different way, because then you can have people who are concentrating on something else, which is what we've often said people should be concentrating more on.
Which was what my reform would have done. It would have basically been a nationalist system and of a version for every one of the panels. And they would have each been a big national constituency.
So why do we think? Why is it that, as you say, Marie, in the run-up to every election, everyone's mad for reform and then it just gets quietly shelved? And
because you need the door
tiptoed away from in the weeks and years that follow.
I thought it was fascinating that Enda Kenny spoke about, you know, so many years going with no reform, and he was there for all those years virtually. I mean, he came up, to be fair to Enda Kenny, when he did have the 11 nominations for the Taoiseach nominees in 2011, he had some inspired choices, President Company included, and fair play, they were largely apolitical. But then on a whim, without mentioning it to anyone, he decides let's abolish the Shannon.
There was a bit of diversion going on there.
It
as
was
well.
A populist stunt at the time, because the country was still, you know, still sore and feeling the pain. And the Labour Party rode in, even though it wasn't in the programme for government.
Wasn't it announced at a Fine Gael dinner, John? Am I remembering this right?
He was in serious trouble at the time, in 2010. And he threw it out there as a diversionary tactic without... Well, any great thought at all. It was announced at the presidential dinner, I think, on a Saturday night.
Right. Indeed.
Francis Fitzgerald had a heart attack.
It did not go unnoticed by the Fine Gael senators when they were seething in indignation that the Shannon was going to be abolished, that they were the ones who had saved Enda during the internal Fine Gael putsch. Yeah. He did not have a majority of the TDs vote for him. He was saved in his leadership by the vote of the parliamentary party by a majority of the senators. So they felt it was a tad ungrateful of him to try and abolish the Shannon after they had done this.
But there's a question, of course, of whether or not it is deemed to be in the interest of the Dáil to facilitate a reform of the Shannon. I thought it was quite ironic hearing Owen Murphy there at the start of the programme, because I remember Owen Murphy up at the McGill Summer School complaining bitterly that backbenchers were just fodder, you know, that they were just there to rubber stamp decisions that had already been made by the Cabinet.
He was right.
And of course he was right about that. And yet at the same time, when it came... to this question of the Shannon, he was rowing in behind.
Just in relation to that, I mean,
on the bandwagon.
In relation to the relationship between the Dáil and the Shannon, I mean, does the Dáil really take a blind bit of notice to what the Shannon is doing, unless you know they pull them up short on a piece of legislation?
I think in committees, my experience when you have the joint committees, if you have it working effectively, like I remember. Particularly on health and children, you know, I was sitting beside Caoimhín Ó'Caolán, and we'd often would say that he would bring the local piece of it and I would have the national policy piece. And when you bring that together and worked well at committee level, it was really good.
You do get the impression sometimes when ministers are hauled into the Shannon that they would rather be anywhere else, that they resent this intrusion. And I'm sure people who've been in the Shannon would have picked up on that.
One of them once said, you folks are just in here talking to yourself, no one is listening, from the minister's chair. Actually, very memorably, in the same session when he accused me of licking myself on air.
Because you were so enamoured with yourself.
I bet you go home and lick yourself every night.
How would anyone get that impression?
But some ministers did use wife.
And I was going to say that some ministers were more open.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To what the senators had to say and the suggestions that they had. And it goes back to the idea that it's a less partisan atmosphere and it's more conducive, perhaps, to constructive amendments being accepted.
But I also think, too, as what Gillian was saying there earlier on, that some legislation that is very sensitive and they want it dealt with in a collegial fashion, they don't want any bitterness about it.
Tactically, they'll take it into the Shannon.
And they've all said... They will all say, and whether they mean it or not, I think a lot of them do mean it, that, you know, they thank the Shannon, saying that they've had a much better response, or perhaps an easier response, because in the Dáil there is a consideration on parties who are in opposition, perhaps, to push against a legislation, even if it is for the common good.
One of the low points for me in it was a time when one of the best senators in our Senate, Colin Burke, who is a Fine Gael senator, a lawyer, a very serious legislator, somebody who really did scrutinise bills and proposed very good amendments and, you know, brought in a really excellent and practical bill on the issue of mandating professional indemnity insurance for other health professionals beyond doctors. And it was a really well thought out bill, and there was actually a gap that needed to be done. And between the time he proposed the bill and it worked its way through the bureaucracy and the time it came to the chamber for debate and vote, the party had whipped him to vote against his own bill. And we had this bizarre situation where he was proposing a really well thought out bill that people who were in the chamber actually knew something about, thought it was a wonderful idea, and then the word came down, sorry, you must oppose it.
Okay, we've only got a few seconds left. John Downing, will we ever see reform? Will anybody actually have the political capital, the wherewithal to move on this?
Unless something cathartic happens, like happened with the Dáil, where they just had to change the manner of action. If something similar were to happen with the Shannon, which isn't beyond the bounds of possibility, the way numbers are changing, the indirect election, there is that possibility. I think there's always something more pressing to be done. It's a bit like going to county council meetings long ago. There was usually an item at the end, reform of standing orders. Before, it was always number 24 or 25, and they all ran out the door before they could get to that dreary thing.
Okay. I'm going to have to take a break here, but stay with us.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And we're right out of time. Just time for one quick text. Thanks to everyone for a really interesting and informative discussion on the Shannon. I took the scenic route home to be able to hear more of it in the car. Yeah. More of this, please. And that's it. Tonight's programme was produced by Regina Henley. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. Kieran Cullen was on sound. I want to thank my panel and thank you all for listening. And hand you over now to Colin Murray on Late Date.